Blog Talk Radio.
In these days of tea parties and constitution rallies, we're all looking back to our founding fathers for a little bit of wisdom. Samuel Adams said, "It does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority, keen on setting the brush fires of freedom in the hearts of men." This is the voice of an irate, tireless minority of one. We'll be talking about politics, religion, and doing what's right. And you can call me Mom.
You're lost, you don't know where you are, you're all alone. You're in the dark and you don't know where to find the light.
Welcome to this week's Irate Tireless Minority, a gem of an election. And I am going to try to explain something that involves this generation's magicians. That's right, computer programs and programmers. I was hoping to try and get somebody from Black Box Voting on, but I didn't see this in time to make that contact with them. I sent them an interview request, but I did not hear back. I was hoping to do that. But that does not mean that I can't talk about this stuff, and I am hoping to shed a little light on it. The description says, "What is the GEMS system, and why should you care?" And here's the answer. It's a quote from Stalin. "It is enough that the people know there was an election. The people who cast the votes decide nothing. The people who count the votes decide everything." And the GEMS system is a tabulating system that is used to tabulate the votes. So even if you vote on a paper ballot, which I do, it doesn't matter because the totals, you know, they count up the totals of those paper ballots and then they put them into a tabulation program. Into a tabulating program that adds up all the votes from all across the state. And howdy, Red Fox Blogger, good to see you today. And I have links in the show description to an article by Bev Harris that is from 2003 or so, and then the video that she just put out on Halloween at blackboxvoting.org called Fraction Magic. And you'll want to see Fraction Magic, the detail version. It's also on YouTube. And it's telling me that the problem that they found in 2003 has not been fixed or addressed. And I know it hasn't because I would have heard about it, and so would have anybody else who's paying attention. And what you find is, I'm just going to go through the issue here. A vote manipulation technique has been found in the Diebold Central tabulator by entering a two-digit code in a hidden location. And I think that code has been updated to four digits because really a two-digit code, come on, that's 100 different possibilities. You could crack that by yourself in less than 5 minutes. 0001, 02. Two-digit code, who does that? Somebody who wants to make it easy and who thinks that nobody else knows about it. But anyway, by entering a two-digit code in a hidden location, a second set of votes is created. This set of votes can be changed so that it no longer matches the correct votes. The voting system will then read the totals from the bogus vote set. It takes only seconds to change the votes, and to date, not a single location in the U.S., and the date here was 2003, but I don't think anything has changed here. Not a single location in the U.S. has implemented security measures to fully mitigate the risks. This program is not stupidity or sloppiness. It was designed and tested over a series of a dozen version adjustments. Whether you vote absentee, on touch screens, or on paper ballot, optical scan machines, all votes are ultimately brought to the mothership, the central tabulator at the county, which adds them all up and creates the results report. These systems, in 2003, are used in over 30 states and each counts up to 2 million votes at once. The central tabulator is far more vulnerable than the touchscreen terminals. Think about it. If you were going to tamper with an election, would you rather tamper with 4,500 individual voting machines or with just one machine, the central tabulator, which receives votes from all the machines? Of course, the central tabulator is the most desirable target. And for public officials on this 2003 thing, she has a little note that says, if you contact her, she can walk you through a diagnostic procedure over the phone to see if you have this particular problem. And her findings in 2003, remember, this is her article from 2003, is that the GEM Central Tabulator Program is incorrectly designed and highly vulnerable to fraud. Election results can be changed in a matter of seconds. Part of the program we examined appears to be designed with election tampering in mind. Did you hear that? Designed with election tampering in mind. And we have learned that election officials maintain inadequate controls over access to the central tabulator, which means anybody can go up to that central tabulator and plug in their two-digit code and change things. But it's even worse than that. They can call in over a modem and do this. They can call into the machine itself, if I'm reading this correctly. They don't even have to go into the central tabulator machine. They can call it in. And again, this was in 2003, but I don't think anything's been changed or she wouldn't have had to release the Fraction Magic video. And what happens is that there's a program overlay that changes the votes into sort of money, which gives them a decimal. And when you have that decimal, you can manipulate the numbers, and you can also make a program that makes it not show the decimal to anybody who doesn't need to know. But with that decimal, you can take fractions of votes and change the totals. And of course, sophisticated people would want to make it match the polling. But if you have a close race, that means how much do you have to manipulate? You don't have to manipulate those numbers by very much. And let's see here. She goes over what happened in 2003 and 4. And there's quite the list. I'm going to see what I can do here. November 2003, black box voting founder Bev Harris filed a KeyTam lawsuit in California citing fraudulent claims by Diebold seeking restitution for the taxpayer. Diebold claimed its voting system was secure. It is, in fact, highly vulnerable and appears to be designed for fraud. The California Attorney General was made aware of this problem nearly a year ago, and they visited Bev Harris and Andy Stevenson visited the Washington Attorney General's office in February 2004 to inform them of the problem, yet nothing has been done to inform election officials who are using the system, nor have appropriate security safeguards been implemented. April 21, 2004, appeared before the California Voting Systems Panel, presented the smoking gun document showing that Diebold had not corrected the GEMS flaws, even though it had updated and upgraded the GEMS program. August 8, 2004, Harris demonstrated to Howard Dean how easy it is to change votes in GEMS on CNBC-TV. August 11, 2004, Jim March formally requested that the California Voting System Panel watch the demonstration of the double set of books and GEMS. They were already convened, and the time for Harris was already allotted. Though the demonstration takes only 3 minutes, the panel refused to allow it and would not look. They did, however, meet privately with Diebold afterwards without informing the public or issuing any report of what transpired. On August 18th of 2004, Harris and Stevenson, together with computer security expert Dr. Hugh Thompson and former King County election supervisor Julianne Kempf, met with members of the California Voting Systems Panel and the California Secretary of State's office to demonstrate the double set of books. The officials declined to allow a camera crew from 60 Minutes to film or attend. Secretary of State's office halted the meeting, called in the general counsel for their office, and a defense attorney from the California Attorney General's office. They refused to allow Black Box Voting to videotape its own demonstration. They prohibited any audio tape and specified that no notes of the meeting could be requested in public records requests. Ooh, that's open and transparent. The Undersecretary of State, Mark Kyle, left the meeting early, and one voting panel member, John Mott Smith, appeared to sleep through the presentation. On August 23, 2004, CBC-TV came to California and filmed the demonstration. August 30th and 31st, 2004, Harris and Stevenson went to New York to demonstrate the double set of books, and now they're talking about other events planned after 2004, which was into the public. And let's see. Diebold has known of the problem, or should have known, because it did cease. It did a cease and desist on the website when Harris originally reported the problem in 2003. In 2004, she offered to show the problem to Marvin Singleton, Diebold's damage control expert, and other Diebold execs. They refused to look. Why don't you want to look? Suppose you are formally informed that the gas tank tends to explode on the car you're telling people to use. If you know about it but do nothing, you are liable. And her goal is to say, let there be no one who can say, I didn't know. Now, in the new video, she says, right now, the GEMS program, because it's a program, is installed in counting votes on 25 states and 616 jurisdictions, in 25 states and 616 jurisdictions. But fractional counting, which is the thing that makes it possible to change the totals and cheat. Fractional counting began to migrate from the GEMS program into other vendors, GEMS, Dominion, Hart, and I think there was one more. Voting systems which count the votes as fractions, which is the vulnerable ones, may count as many as 99% of the American votes in 2016. 99%. And if that's not concerning to you as a voter, then you need to pay attention. Hi, Bigfoot. Good to see you there. And I don't even know how to pronounce whatever symbol you're using, but glad to see you and welcome guest. Oh, all right, Red Fox, you're saying that's balderdash. I'm assuming you're just being outraged at the idea that somebody could plug in a little number or call in a number over a phone to the central tabulator and change the election results. I am outraged at the very idea. And I called all of my congressional representatives yesterday, and I referred to them the video that is linked in the show description called Fraction Magic. It's called Fraction Magic. And it's on blackboxvoting.org. Now, I'm going to... This is taking up a long time. Oh, Mamma Mia No Sharia, hello Vito to the chat room. I'm going to try and tell you how this voting changes, how these voting changes are accomplished. What it is according to election industry officials, the central tabulator is secure because it's protected by passwords and audit logs, but it turns out that the GEMS passwords can easily be bypassed and the audit logs can be altered and erased. Worse, the votes can be changed without anyone knowing, including the officials who run the election. The GEMS program runs on a Microsoft Access database. It typically receives incoming votes by modem, though some counties follow better security by disconnecting modems and bringing votes in physically. GEMS stores the votes in a vote ledger built in Microsoft Access. Any properly designed accounting program will only allow one set of books. You can't enter your expense report in three different places, because that'll mess up the numbers, right? All data must be drawn from the same place, and multiple versions are never acceptable. But in the files we examined, we found that the GEM system contained not one, not two, but three sets of books. Books. The voting stuff. The election official, the guy who's responsible, or gal who's responsible, never sees the different sets of books. All he or she sees is the reports that they can run. Election summaries, totals countywide, or a statement of votes cast, totals for each precinct. That's all they see. They have no way of knowing that their GEM system uses a different set of data for the detail report, which is used to spot check, than it does for the election totals. The access database, which contains the hidden set of votes, can't be seen unless you know how to get in the back door, which only takes seconds. Now it says, and this goes on to explain how this gets in there. And on the video, she's got a programmer who she brought in to look at these programs that she found. And he could not believe it. He couldn't believe it. And you can see that on the video. And let's see, could the double set of books be legitimate? From a programming standpoint, there might be reasons to have a special vote ledger that disengages from the real one. For example, election officials might say they need to be able to alter the votes to add provisional ballots or absentee ballots. If so, this calls into question the training of these officials. If election officials are taught to deal with changes by overwriting votes, regardless of whether they do this in Vote Ledger 1 or Vote Ledger 2, it's improper. Also, if it was legitimate, it would be a menu item in the GEMS program, not executed in a hidden location triggered by a secret two-digit code. Nothing in the GEMS documentation describes the use of any feature like this whatsoever. Here's why we need to involve CPAs in vote tabulation regulations, procedures, and design. If changing election data is required, the corrective entry must be made not by overriding vote totals, but by making a corrective entry. It's never acceptable to make changes by overriding. Data corrections should not be prohibited, but must always be done by indicating the changes through a clearly marked line item that preserves each transaction. You can't just go in and change the vote totals and not leave something that shows that those vote totals were changed and for what reason and by whom. And that's another one of the problems with the central tabulator thing is that everybody's using the same password, because what happens, let's see if I can find that section. Because when you've... Okay, I found it. How many people can have passwords to GEMS? A sociable GEMS user can give all his friends access to the vote database. We added 50 people and gave them all the same password, which was password. So far, we haven't found a limit to how many people can be granted access. And you've got election officials, you've got the Diebold technicians, you've got all sorts of people who could be temps or whatever. But let's see, we found that you can melt down an election in 6 seconds simply by using the menu item in GEMS. You can destroy all data with 2 mouse clicks, and with 4 mouse clicks you can destroy the configuration of the election, making it very difficult to reload the original data. And let's see here. They're talking about the passwords, and they're talking about how if you're going to change something, you have to enter a password. But in order to enter a password for a separate user, you had to shut down the entire machine to do that and then restart it. And you can't be shutting down the machine and restarting it in the middle of an election, so everybody uses the same password. Which means people can go in and change stuff, and you don't know who they are or where things were changed because they're all using the same password, because they don't want to have to shut down the tabulating machine. excuse me. So this is a big flipping deal. And the fact that she's got out, she's got this video out this year shows me that we have not done nearly enough. And here we are. And I want you to think about this. It doesn't have to be a presidential election, although in this election, how much money is going into this election? I mean, why pay people to get violent at Trump rallies when you can just pay people to hijack the system? Pay somebody for every county. It's going to cost you less than what they're putting out for advertising. And what if you don't want to influence a presidential election? What if you just want to influence who gets elected to the county board or the city board or as dog catcher or as the person who's giving out permits for this and that, some sort of secretary position? You know, the small local races that hardly anybody pays attention to. But I want to bring your attention. How many of you remember the name Alvin Green? Anybody remember him? Alvin Green, in the 2010 election, got the, in a surprise election of Democrat Alvin Green in the South Carolina Senate primary, it was a baffling 18-point victory for an unknown, unemployed, inarticulate Army veteran who gave no speeches, distributed no literature, and won no endorsements in a non-campaign against experienced Paul Victor Rall. How did it happen? How did 59% of 169,542 South Carolinians decide to cast a vote for a man they'd never heard of? Though there have been plenty of allegations of fraud, nothing has been proved. But there are plenty of theories, and while none is significant enough by itself to explain an 18-point margin of victory, taken together, they may begin to explain Green's surprise win. The most popular hypothesis so far is that Green's name simply appeared before his opponents, known as the ballot position effect. Really, really, they are reaching. They are reaching and reaching hard. I'm thinking Alvin Green was able somehow to manipulate the GEM system. That's what I think. Can't be proved because there's no traces. And that's why I call computer programmer the wizards of this generation, of this point in time. Because everything we do on the computer is shaped by the people who programmed it. The how you use Microsoft Office, shaped by what's available in Office, by the programmers who created it. You know, I'm even your thinking. How could your thinking be influenced by the things you use online? The very channels of your thinking are shaped by what's available, because there's no reason to think about something else if you can't do it. This is not an available thing. It would be nice if I could do this, but I can't, so I'm just going to forget about that. Yeah, check Hillary's emails. Bet you could prove it then. I don't know. I would think that if somebody was doing this on that level, they would be pretty reluctant to talk about it openly. And verbal codes and, you know, stuff like that are kind of difficult to break. But by how much would the percentages have to be changed in order to give one candidate a boost over the other, especially when, even though Ms. Clinton and her VP cannot draw enough people to fill a high school auditorium. What did her VP got 30 people the other day, and I think she had like 50 people. Mr. Trump goes someplace, and you've got a stadium full of people and thousands of people waiting outside who couldn't get in. And yet, the pollsters tell us it's a close race with Hillary in the lead. Really? But see, if we believe that it was always a close race, then if they have close totals at the end, who's going to think, oh, that's not right? How can we double check that? it's a conundrum. And I just want to put that out there. And now I've got, 5 minutes to deal with the rest of it? Religion, Forsaking the Great Commission. And that is linked to a video by Vlad Tepes blog on YouTube, where Stephen Coughlin questions the Arlington Refugee Meeting. And if you don't know, what the Arlington Refugee Meeting is, it was a meeting between a meeting at St. Anne's Church and refugee resettlement about refugee resettlement in the U.S., a national and local humanitarian response. It was organized jointly by the Catholic Diocese of Arlington and the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And people were not encouraged to share information about this meeting. No press. We don't want anything coming out of here. But somebody videoed some of it and got audio stuff. Presentation was led by Anastasia Brown, the director of the Division of Refugee Services in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Office of Refugee Resettlement. Ms. Brown is also the former director of Refugee Programs for the Migration and Refugee Services of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And after the presentation, Major Stephen Coughlin, U.S. Army retired, the author of Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad, had some questions for Ms. Brown. And one of them, the most telling question, the most pertinent question from a standpoint of forever and living forever and one's eternal soul, is basically, how can you ask a church, a Christian church, to forsake the Great Commission in order to help people? Because, you know, short-term pain, long-term gain. Oh, you have to listen to a little sermon, but you get a lot of help, and you might have your eternal soul saved. But churches agree not to preach or proselytize to these refugees that they get money for bringing in. What kind of church does that? What kind of Christian church says, oh, we are going to be the officiants for this so we get money, but we're going to leave those poor people to rot in hell for eternity because we're going to forsake the Great Commission because otherwise we won't be able to bring them in and get money for them? Oh, but probably they're saying, oh, but we're bringing them here and this is a Christian country and they'll see by example. Well, no. Your job as a church, is to lead the way. The Great Commission, for those who may not know, is the commission to go out and spread the gospel to every living creature. Every person. That is the job of the church. That's what they are supposed to be doing. Are you supposed to help people? Yes, you have an individual duty to help people and be helpful where you can and be helpful in a way that draws them closer to God by your example. But if you're going to say, oh, give me money to get these people in, and I agree not to tell them about God while I'm doing it. Oh, yes, and the director there said, oh, no, they can talk about God. They just can't do it while they're doing the activities for which they're getting the money. And when else are these churches going to have contact with these people? Are they going to go to the neighborhoods afterwards and invite themselves to dinner? I don't think so. This is the greatest chance to proselytize to these people. And the churches say, oh, okay, we agree not to do so for money. These are not churches. These are businesses. And we need to stop getting them in there. And doing what's right, secure the vote and inform yourself before you vote. There's a poll out that shows that people know nothing. Voters are broadly ignorant about issues that impact them. And this is from stream.org. If there's truth in Benjamin Franklin's precept that tyranny begins with ignorance, a poll commissioned by Just Facts shows that the U.S. may be in deep trouble. And the result for all voters is that in total, the rates at which voters gave the correct answers varied from a high of 43% for Trump voters to a low of 31% for Clinton voters, which tells you something. And here's one question. on average, who would you say pays a greater portion of their income in federal taxes, the middle class or the upper 1% of income earners? The correct answer is the upper 1%. And let's see here. The correct answer, 12% of all voters answered correctly, 8% of Clinton voters, 18% of Trump voters, 11% of undecided voters. But there's a bunch of questions like that, and it shows you exactly how biased people are towards their own opinions, many of which have been shaped by the mainstream media. And we're all an irate, tireless minority of one. We can all make a difference. Have a great week.